Hello, it's Thursday, 18th of June. I'm Hannah Pearson from Payer Anderson.
And I'm Gary Bowerman from Check In Asia.
On today's show, we're taking a look at Southeast Asia's airline skyscape as travel starts to emerge from the COVID darkness.
We'll attempt to unpick the complex interplay of airlines, governments, and travel bans, which is confusing travelers across the region, including us, Hannah.
Yes.
So let's get started. This is the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Hello, wherever you are in the world, and thanks for listening in. Well, first things first, Gary, it's lovely to be back in the same room to record a podcast together, isn't it?
It really is.
Yeah, we've been recording from separate locations in KL ever since lockdown was imposed in early March. So this is like a new era for us.
It really is. That's very true, Hannah. So let's make this first episode of the Recovery Movement Control Order, as it's called here in Malaysia. Let's make it really count.
Yes.
And where do we start? Well, airlines, aviation, and by extension, airports. What a mess. It's no wonder travellers are confused. We're confused, Hannah.
We are.
The early stages of the post-COVID recovery have been plagued by bailouts, air bubbles that haven't come to fruition, governments announcing and delaying the lifting of travel bans, and different states within countries being treated or responding differently in some cases. Mm-hmm. We've also got quarantines, we've got high fares, we've got flight cancellations, the list goes on. So we said at the top of the show, Hannah, we will try to unpick this complex situation. And that, to be honest, is just as much for ourselves as it is for the listeners.
Absolutely. And, you know, we've seen very little coming together from ASEAN institutions to enable that seamless return to the skies for airlines, even on a national basis in some cases. Although, you know, some of this is because different countries in the region are still battling COVID-19. Some countries are staying with domestic travel only, and others want to try and open their borders ASAP.
Yeah, very true.
You know, at the same time, airlines have now started to promote heavily. They're trying to entice forward bookings to improve cash flow. It's really chaotic, isn't it, like you said? And at the moment, consumers are in the dark. Travel agencies are tour operators in some cases. Even the airports
That's
don't know
true.
What's going on.
Yeah.
Rebuilding traveler confidence has got to be more streamlined than this, hasn't it?
Yeah, and then this week, obviously, we've got the overlay of the Beijing COVID-19 outbreak, which, you know, a lot of airlines were really hoping to reopen flights from China. That's added more complexity.
Absolutely.
But we've seen no movement perhaps understandably on this ASEAN single airline aviation market, which, you know, had been proposed back in 2007. The Open Skies Agreement would have given airlines much greater freedom to operate routes from between different countries in Southeast Asia in a similar way as you've got in the European Union. Now, I guess it's understandable that that's been put off during the last 6 months, but it really has dragged on, and it's political wrangling that I think has made our skies so complicated in political reasons.
And of course, there's cost cutting too. So Gary, I have to ask you, what do you think about this idea of banning alcohol on flights?
Well, I commented about this on social media yesterday, and I got a bit of feedback about it. You know, we're seeing some airlines, particularly in the US, in Europe, and also here in Asia, saying they're going to ban alcohol on flights. The reasons that they're giving is they don't want to have too much interaction between cabin staff and passengers. Mm-hmm. I mean, that seems pretty strange given that, you know, we have these airline CEOs that are going on record to tell us how secure the HEPA filters are and that traveling is so safe on flights.
Yeah.
You know, in most cases going forward, we're going to have to be COVID safe before we actually board the flight.
True.
So actually serving a beer or a glass of wine seems a little bit strange. Mm. It does look like this is cost cutting to me.
Do you think so?
Through the back door, yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, I even saw an airline said that they were going to ban hot drinks. No hot drinks.
Yeah.
Which I can't quite. Is it because you hold your cup of tea or your cup of coffee a little bit longer? You've got to blow on it? Maybe is it the blowing on it to cool it down? I don't know.
I mean, the interesting issue here is that, you know, obviously airlines do have to take every safety precaution that they can. They're going to not cut any corners here. But in terms of actually reassuring passengers, It doesn't really send out the right message, I don't think. Basically, you're going to get on a flight, not be able to do anything. You're going to have no magazine to read.
Yeah.
You're not going to be served any drinks. That's not a huge incentive to get on board.
It's not, is it? So, those are our rants over for now. So let's begin, as we usually do, by taking stock of the statistical situation. So over to you, Gary.
Yeah, well, let's have a look at the airline seat capacity in Southeast Asia as it stood on the 15th of June. These are figures from OAG, which we use quite regularly.
Yep.
So if you look back at 29th of January, when COVID-19 was starting to spread across Asia, there were almost 10.9 million flights at that time per week. Now, on the 15th of June, that was down to about 3.6 million, which is minus 5.9% on the week before.
Yeah.
But generally, in the period since 29th of January, that's down 67.1%. So that's two-thirds down.
Yeah.
Now, there are, as we're seeing, a lot of airlines are moving up and down with their capacities, trying to find where the equilibrium point is going forward. It's very difficult for them.
Absolutely.
Because they are fighting, as we said, so many different issues from governments, airports, this kind of thing, travel bans. So the reopening of services in the Philippines added over 100,000 extra weekly seats in the Southeast Asian market last week. So that's positive. But on the negative side, capacity cuts by Lion Air and Batik Air in Indonesia meant that the overall result was 5.9% regional decline on weekly capacity.
And if we look at the top 10 airlines globally for capacity in week of 15 of June, there were no Southeast Asian carriers there. But interestingly, if we actually look at the top 10 global markets, so we're considering it as a country rather than specific airlines for seat capacity, yes, China, US, Japan were first, second and third, but Indonesia sneaks in there at number four, down 51.6% versus January, and Vietnam was seventh, down only 27.1%. It's pretty impressive being only 27.1% down. And given that only domestic flights are currently permitted, we found a great graphic that OAG produced in a recent webinar, which was about the different capacities and reliance of Southeast Asian airlines on domestic versus international. And actually, they have a really big dependence on domestic flights, don't they?
Yeah.
So Thailand, 46% of their flights are normally domestic. You've got Malaysia, which is 52%, yeah. Vietnam, 65%, and Philippines, 65%. And of course, Singapore, well, there's 0%, right? Because what domestic flights can you do in a city state? But they raised up an interesting point as well, didn't they, Gary, that yes, they have that domestic mix there, and it is a big majority, but it is still powered by those connections. So a lot of travel in Thailand, say they will connect, international flights will connect through Bangkok and then go out and do the regional flights. So still, if you still don't have those international passengers powering the domestic flights, your domestic flights are still not going to go back to the same levels as we saw last year. Even if, you know, all of them are operating, you're still not going to get that same passenger level.
Yeah, and then, and on that point, there was a good quote this week from the permanent secretary at the Ministry of Transport and Communications in Myanmar, who said that domestic airlines are costly to operate and most rely on foreigners to fill their seats. Many airlines also operate code share flights in the monsoon season and some under joint ventures. But the point there is that, you know, although these flights are actually domestically, a lot of it is powered by inbound travelers.
Yes, so until those borders open up, we're still not going to see it returning to, you know, a decent level of load factor.
No, and another thing that I saw, I think this was in the Malaysian press this week, was that there's been a little bit of a surge in people going to Penang or to Langkawi.
Yeah.
But there is a concern that it is an initial surge, and that after they've done that for the first trip, they may not travel again for a while. So, you know, we could see these sort of dips and troughs.
Yeah, I mean, it could happen, especially in Malaysia. We don't have that many kind of long weekends coming up. I imagine a lot of people have been forced to take unpaid leave or use up previous leave from last year, you know, maybe that they would have carried over usually. So are people even going to have the leave to be able to travel?
Yeah, that's a good point. That's a really good point.
You know, and places like Thailand, yes, they're still talking about the Songkran holidays, which are cancelled, and they're planning to put them forward, aren't they? But the government still haven't even decided at what point.
Right, so that's the up-to-date situation for air markets in the region. So now let's look at the airline sectors. Firstly, the state flag carriers, those unwieldy and often inflexible airlines that carry the burden of government expectations with, in many cases, highly questionable management strategies. But before we look at the SEA situation, Hannah, I wanted to look with some regional context and a quote from Patrick Healy, who's the chairman of Cathay Pacific, which is based in Hong Kong, and is one of Asia's largest airlines.
It is.
Now, it's just secured a Hong Kong $39 billion lifeline, which is about US $5 billion, from the Hong Kong government. And on June the 9th, he said, recapitalization was basically the only plan available. Quite frankly, without this plan, the alternative would have been the collapse of the company.
Mm-hmm.
I think that shows pretty clearly the disastrous impact on state carriers of COVID-19, which in some cases also exposed the business model fragilities that existed before the pandemic.
Absolutely.
But, you know, if Cathay Pacific is suffering, it's such a big airline in terms of connectivity globally. Mm. It has the strong China market as well.
Yeah.
You know, that really shows the difficulties that these airlines are facing.
It does. So, I mean, let's look at Thai Airways first, because they're the one that are in the news the most at the moment, aren't they?
Yeah.
So Thai Airways have just, they're undergoing what they call rehabilitation process, don't they?
Nicely phrased.
Rehabilitation, which is very similar to Chapter 11. So it's basically, they're undergoing a bankruptcy process, but they're not really going bankrupt.
Yeah, because they get protected from the creditors, so the creditors can't really claim the debts that they're owed, which are huge.
Yes, it is huge. And the other, I mean, the sticking point for that, or the tough point for consumers and probably travel agencies, is that means that they're actually unable to give refunds for the next, I think, 6 months.
Yeah.
So that's not going to go down very well with
Well, yeah, and I mean, it said this week that, you know, the turnaround plan, once they actually, I think they have to go to court, go to Thailand's bankruptcy court in August, so that's still 6 weeks away. But the actual plan in terms of turning around this airline could take 1 year to put in place.
Wow.
So the airline will still be able to operate in that time, but it is burdened by huge debts. Obviously, it's going to have to get some funding from the Thai government. You know, we won't really know for a year what the future airline will actually look like.
Yeah, I mean, it's likely that they're going to have big, big cuts, though they've said they haven't made any just yet. I think they said that. But
yeah. And cost reductions for sure. I mean, it's going to have to really slash down its costs, which will probably mean staff. It'll probably mean flight routes,
exactly.
Frequencies.
Yeah.
Yeah, it looks like whatever Thai Airways is going to be, it will be a very different airline to what it is today.
Yeah, I mean, and that's really going to affect the kind of Mekong countries as well, because a lot of these countries really rely on connectivity with Thailand for international tourism to get in there. So whatever Thailand or Thai Airways do is going to affect them indirectly too.
Yeah.
And we've already seen them push back their start dates. So I think originally they said they were going to start back flying on 1st of July. That's now been pushed to 1st of August.
Yeah. Yeah,
really.
And another interesting part about this particular airline is it used to be 51% owned by Thailand's finance ministry.
Mm.
Now, that gave it state enterprise status, which is relatively protected status. Well, it's highly protected status. But 3.1% of the company has now been sold by the finance ministry. So that takes their owning below 50%.
Yeah.
So in terms of how the reorganization of this company will be and the input of the finance ministry into the management board and things like that, that's going to be another big question. Because the strategy that's been put in place in recent years has been very questionable.
It was probably overdue for this kind of rehaul, I think most analysts agree.
Yeah.
But it's still going to be really painful.
Yeah, which brings us, I think next we should look at Malaysia Airlines, because that's had similar problems for many years.
Yes.
It's had many different CEO changes, management board changes.
Yes.
It's now wholly owned by Khazanah, which is the sovereign wealth fund. Mm-hmm. It's the only shareholder of this company.
Yeah.
It has pumped in billions of ringgit in recent years. There's been various turnaround plans. Earlier this year, under the previous government, there were the possibility that they would sell off at least a stake in the airline, possibly close the airline, look at a way of restructuring it. But it just looks like right now, the situation post-COVID is it will probably get another finance boost. And go through another turnaround plan.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? I mean, they've already gone through so many CEOs recently,
yeah.
all with grand plans who have all departed. And that, you know, potentially speaks to the difficulty that whoever, you know, that the management are going to face.
But the real-time impact is obviously, as you said just there, Hannah, you know, obviously this is a big airline. It employs 13,000 people here in Malaysia. It's closely linked to the industry, so it really affects the tour operators, the travel agents. You know, although it is a state flag carrier, it carries the Malaysia brand around the world.
Mm.
The actual impact here in Malaysia is very, very strong in terms of jobs, employment, and the future of this industry. We don't really know how the travel industry is going to reshape in Malaysia or across Southeast Asia at the moment.
True.
But you do suspect that the government will want Malaysia Airlines to play a key role in however that recovery happens.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, I can't see them letting them go bankrupt
and
the brand disappearing. I don't think so.
No, which brings us further down the peninsula to Singapore Airlines.
So Singapore Airlines, yes. I mean, Singapore Airlines have now had 19 billion Sing dollars from Temasek Holdings, who are, and it's, you know, the world's biggest rescue of an airline. And Singapore Airlines finds itself in very much the same position as Cathay Pacific, in that there's no domestic market to support it. So when you cut routes and international borders are closed, they literally can't operate, can they? Yeah. So.
And that's a very good comparison between those two airlines, because obviously Hong Kong and Singapore are the two most connective airports in our region.
Yeah.
They link the continents, as well as linking our own continent here. Across Northeast Asia, Southeast Asia, Australia as well, and into Europe, into the Americas as well. So Singapore Airlines is very pivotal to the Singaporean economy.
Yes.
If we go back to early February, when the Singapore government did their first budget, you know, to counteract the impact of COVID, they said right from the outset, Singapore Airlines and Changi Airport were so important to the economy, and they would take steps to protect them, whatever, because it is an international economy. It is so international in terms of its travel and tourism sector, but also its business sector, its trading, its commerce. It needs the airline and it needs the airport. As we know, Changi Airport has been operating on only two of its four terminals recently, and has just deferred the construction of the fifth terminal for a couple of years. So they're obviously not expecting the turnaround to come any very quickly or in the volume of what it would hope for. But protecting the airline and protecting the airport is very important.
Yeah, I mean, and you do wonder whether the kind of bailout also influenced Cathay Pacific, because, of course, the two hubs are competitors, aren't they?
Absolutely.
Hong Kong and Singapore.
Absolutely. And actually, the competition between the two actually benefits both. It really does, because it keeps them very competitive, keeps the airports improving in terms of the amenities and facilities and the services that it offers.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we need both those airlines. We need both those airports to keep the industry strong in the region.
Another kind of flagship national carrier, Garuda Indonesia. So they have narrowly avoided defaulting on their $500 million Islamic bonds after they managed to agree to extend its maturity by 3 years. But it was a bit of a touch and go thing.
It was
really getting towards the end of the time. And they've had a really rough few years as well, haven't they?
Yeah. They've had many CEOs too.
Yeah.
They've had many board changes. But it was startling. I was looking at some figures about how their revenues are actually generated. And Mecca trips each year actually comprise 15% of their revenues, 15%. And the China market is 5%. So combined, that's 20. Yeah. That's a fifth of their business. At the moment, it's got no chance of coming back, not this year.
Yeah, you know, with Indonesia's cancellation of the Hajj pilgrimage this year, that I think that was something between 200 to 300,000 pilgrims all carried by Garuda. Then you cut that, that's huge.
Yeah, it's also an important market here for Malaysia. Obviously, the flights between the two countries are huge. And, you know, there's elements of the tourism market, such as health tourism. You look at areas like Penang or Malacca, even KL does very well on health tourism from Indonesia. But although you said it was touch and go, I think that, you know, Garuda is one of those airlines that seems to have been in trouble for a long time and staggers through.
Yeah.
It manages, it's just because its costs are so high and its strategy just seems to be slightly off point. But it also has, I think, coming towards the end of this year, another $1 billion of bonds which are due to mature. So, you know, there's another looming cloud for it on the horizon, even if it gets through the next few months.
Yeah.
And that's why I suspect that Indonesia has been so keen on keeping its domestic air sector buoyant during this period, because it needs to generate those revenues.
Yeah, you're right, I think. And of course, Indonesia is a bit different to, say, Malaysia or Singapore, in that the market there, the aviation market, is not mature yet.
Yep.
There is still a huge amount more potential.
Yep.
So actually, investors are a little bit more open, I think, to investing money inside Garuda, because they know they're more likely to get it back.
Yep.
Because there are so many more domestic routes that they can develop.
Yep.
So many more people who are going to be traveling.
Yep.
Whereas Singapore is maybe not necessarily the case, right?
Yep.
Once they've expanded to a certain number of international destinations.
Yep.
There's kind of a roof on it. But for Indonesia, you've got that massive population.
Yeah, and that's what you were mentioning to me the other day, Hannah, which is something I hadn't thought about, is the social importance of some of these airlines. You know, it's not just about revenues, it's about connectivity in some parts of this region. It's very difficult to travel overland.
Yeah, it is. You know, you look at very remote places in Malaysia's Borneo, and they really need these, you know, these routes operated by the prop planes. And they're of social importance, aren't they? And even the airlines are under a contract from the government to keep these routes going, because without that connectivity, the communities can't get out. They can't get, you know, vital supplies.
Yeah.
And it's the same with Indonesia. It's the same with the Philippines as well, where you have these very spread out countries, this many, many islands, where the only way to connect really is by plane, unless you're going to take a long ferry there.
So before we move on from the state flag carriers, just want to talk about very, very quickly about Royal Brunei Airlines, which, as we've mentioned on the pod before, Hannah, was developing its flight routes quite well before COVID-19, particularly from China. It was getting some more routes from China. And so it released its schedule for July and August quite recently. And it's only going to be flying 18 weekly flights to five destinations: Hong Kong, Kuala Lumpur, Manila, Melbourne, and Singapore. Now, it also gave quite an interesting quote about why it's retaining those routes. And it's pretty strategic, and it's quite defensive in many ways. It says that it's going to be flying these services to retain vital connectivity for services, supplies, and the small number of guests who are able to travel into other destinations. It needs to keep its slots. I think that's very important. These airlines can't give up those slots because they don't know if they'd ever be able to get them back in or what the cost of rebuying them back would be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and the other thing is a lot of cargo at the moment, isn't it?
Yep.
A lot of airlines are flying passenger planes filled with cargo to places, again, presumably also to keep the slots, but also as an opportunity to just try and make any kind of revenue at this point.
And I think that was enhanced, particularly during the early stages of COVID-19, because a lot of the ports weren't transporting cargo because the supply chains had sort of fallen apart. And so the airlines were providing a vital service. They were also doing repatriation flights as well. That sort of kept them in the air as well. So they've really been looking at absolutely every avenue to keep flights in the air. But it's been so difficult. And you're seeing that some of these airlines, their capacities are down 90%+, 95%+ compared to this time last year. With their costs as high as they are, that's unsustainable.
Yeah, that must be keeping board members up.
And financiers.
So let's look at LCCs then. And of course, they are not without their difficulties either. You know, low-cost airlines are traditionally thought of as a little bit more nimble than these traditional airlines. But, you know, this COVID-19 has affected everybody. Whether you are a national flagship carrier or you are a really nimble little LCC. Of course, the major ones in our region are Air Asia and Lion Air. But you've got some really fast-moving other players, haven't you? People like Vietjet, who are moving on in Thailand and Vietnam.
Yeah, particularly there. I mean, I think it's quite interesting if we go back, which as we always do, is, you know, Air Asia and Lion Air really led over the past 20 years this development of low-cost flying in Southeast Asia, but also between other parts of Asia as well.
Yeah.
They really have sort of carried this to enabling more people to fly. But Vietjet has seen an opportunity in recent years and has really started to aggressively expand and probably take on these two carriers going forward. And now, as it comes out of the pandemic, you know, Vietnam has really grasped the mettle here, and Vietjet are really investing quite considerably. Airlines like Air Asia are in a big, difficult situation. You know, their market has been very, very dependent on China. They have a lot of flights in and out of China, or they did pre-pandemic. And that's a lot of their revenue growth.
Yeah.
That's disappeared.
Yeah.
They also have the Air Asia X, which was loss-making anyway.
Yes.
And we have no idea what's going to happen to that, but it doesn't look good.
It doesn't look good, and they've not really been given any government support, have they? You know, there's not been any talk from the government about helping them, and I think Tony Fernandez has said, you know, they're not getting daddy's handouts.
He said
something along those lines earlier in the week.
The Malaysian press was reporting this week that perhaps they were in discussions with South Korea's SK Holdings to sell a 10% stake in the company. AirAsia has denied this, but they have said that they're looking at new financing options, and it looks as though they absolutely need it to get back off the ground, because at the moment they're only really flying, obviously, domestically.
Yeah, they are. I mean, they've said that they will expand their full domestic flights in Malaysia from the beginning of July. And certainly they have started in the Philippines flying again. I think Indonesia has either just started or will start in the next few days. So they are slowly starting to get their fleet back moving.
And it's an interesting company model that they've had, because they obviously began here in Malaysia. They have the Air Asia Malaysia flagship business, but they have these modular businesses in Thailand, Indonesia, you know, all around the region. And you can see that Vietjet is starting to follow a similar model. It's starting to grow in individual markets.
Yes.
And, you know, that's they've clearly taken note of how AirAsia has done it over recent years.
Yeah, absolutely. And probably taking notes from Lion Air as well. We've got their Malindo, the Malaysian subsidiary. They've got Thailand one too.
Yeah, Malindo Air is an interesting airline because I don't know how long that's been here. It's about 6 or 7 years. Maybe it's slightly more.
Yeah, maybe
than that.
Slightly longer, but it's slightly still a longer, relatively newer player.
But it has been quite successful in terms of adding to the mix in terms of new flights, new services, new destinations.
Yeah, exactly. They had quite an interesting model when they first launched, which was kind of like this hybrid. So you get your luggage included and you get the entertainment in screen, you get the meals, but it's still kind of a low-cost price.
Yeah.
But over the past few years, you've actually seen that kind of be phased out a little bit more with all of these flexible fares. And I think recently they've had to, they've put staff on a voluntary redundancy scheme as well. Because they just, again, they just don't have that support from the government here to keep going.
Which really leads us into talking about, very briefly, you know, the future for these airlines is going to be how they can generate ancillary revenues. You know, they're not going to be able to have that model. As you said, they'd phased that out anyway. They were starting to reduce those benefits. But they're going to have to find new ways of making revenue before, during, and after the flight.
Yeah, but I mean, during the flight, it's going to be pretty grim for ancillary revenue at the moment, aren't they? You know, no in-flight sales. I can't imagine that they will be doing in-flight duty-free because it's just so much more interaction and people touching things and putting things back.
Tough times.
Tough times for revenue managers at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, one interesting thing actually is, you know, the idea of potential mergers. There are so many different LCC players out there. Yep. And Thai Air Asia actually came out, was it a couple of weeks ago?
Yep.
The boss there and said that they were actually considering merging with another low-cost Thai carrier, though they didn't stipulate who, did they? And that rumor has kind of died away.
Yeah.
But it's an interesting concept. Even in Myanmar, you know, you talked about Myanmar earlier, and the government there was saying, look, airlines, you might have to accept the fact that you might have to merge, or you're going to have to help each other out a lot more with co-chairing and things to be able to survive this.
Yeah, it did put it very delicately. I think it said you'll have to work together,
which is
a very delicate way of saying it. But yeah, there's obviously this opportunity of more mergers. Then maybe some new airlines may emerge. We don't know that. I mean, we don't quite know what's going to happen out of Virgin Australia. What's going to happen there? Will that actually be a brand new airline? We don't quite know about that yet. But then on the opposite side of that, we're seeing demergers. So if you look at Jetstar Pacific, which is a really good case, this week, you know, Jetstar Pacific is a Vietnam airline, and it's 70% owned by Vietnam Airlines and 30% by Qantas. Now, Qantas has been saying on the record for a couple of months now that it was looking to actually get rid of its 30% stake. That looks like it's actually happening now. Vietnam Airlines is going to rebrand the airline as Pacific Airlines, which it was originally.
Yep.
It's going to give it new livery, which is based on the Vietnam Airlines colors. Mm. And it does look as though it's actually going to take back that 30% shareholding from Qantas. So it's all to play for there. But although, having said that, you know, Vietnam Airlines itself, although it's so aggressive, it's also in financial difficulties.
It is. I mean, it's a funny thing, isn't it? Because we saw a few weeks ago that there was a rumor that they were considering taking on, how many was it, 50 new planes? And then last week, or beginning of this week, the headlines came out and said that it could run out of money next month as it, you know, if it doesn't receive government credit.
Yeah, yeah.
So they are really playing a fine game.
They are. They're kind of being forced to by Vietjet, I think.
Yeah,
so they're actually having to be aggressive. Mm-hmm. They're actually having to go forward. But, you know, this, I don't know, this is probably not the right comparison, but this reminds me a little bit like Hainan Airlines a few years ago, where it just expanded so fast and it just took on new routes. It bought companies, you know, and it expanded so aggressively and it hit a wall.
Yeah.
It just almost, you know, because basically for two reasons. One, it hit a wall financially.
Mm.
It borrowed much too much money.
Yeah.
And it also got reined in by the government as well, by the Chinese government. So Vietnam Airlines does have the fact that it is it's state owned, whereas HNA was privately owned. But even so, it's saying it needs more money, and it needs a lot of more money.
Trillions of
Vietnamese dong, it's saying.
Yeah, I mean, and you've got another airline in Vietnam, Bamboo, who are coming up as well, and they were set to open up long distance flights this year to Europe. They've even managed to operate. They operated a rescue flight to Italy. I think 2 weeks ago, which they were pretty proud about, kind of opening up that Europe. They've got hot competition.
Yeah. And the US, they were looking at the US, right? Which would, looking at the figures last year in terms of the flights between Vietnam and the US, I think it was about 1.5 million passengers between the two countries last year.
Yeah.
But most of those were run by other airlines, like EVA Air, I think, because there are no actual Vietnamese airlines running direct flights.
Yeah, I think so.
So the US, but they obviously want to plug that gap because there's a lot of revenue to be made there. But having said that, the US market right now in terms of international flying, we have no idea.
Exactly. I mean, and I think we need to talk about this, which is one of the other reasons why airlines are not performing very well is just, you know, they've got limited opportunities and that is forcing them to also raise their FS, right? So they're starting again, but they're starting at a really high price point. And consumers, understandably, are calling on governments to try and get these airfares lowered, particularly, you know, for these longer routes. So in Malaysia, we had this case of flying from KL to Borneo, so to Kuching or Kota Kinabalu, and the flight return was like 2,000 ringgit. And so to put that in context for our listeners, I once bought a flight to London for 2,300 ringgit.
And I believe that there's still a quarantine in place. If you fly from Peninsula mainland and to East Malaysia, I think there is still a quarantine requirement.
Sure. They might have just waived that.
Right. It certainly was in place last week.
It's not an easy one. And of course, airlines are limited. You know, they've been limited by social distancing on the plane, so they've had to keep this middle seat free. And they've been limited by the number of flights that they can operate as well.
Yeah.
But it's...
That is tricky. And you can see it from the airline's point of view. You know, if you're going to expand flights from KL to Penang to Langkawi, you can be pretty sure, especially at weekends, you're going to get quite good returns on those. There will be demand.
Yeah.
But flying between, you know, it's 2.5 hour flight to Kuching. That, it's across the ocean. You just have no idea what the demand will be for those flights. Mm. So how do you actually put in your capacities and change your flight pricing?
Really tricky. I mean, of course, now the government here in Malaysia have said that you no longer have to do social distancing. So airlines are allowed to fill up to, I think, 100% capacity now.
Passengers
have to wear masks. In Indonesia, they've now raised the level to 70%, I think. So previously it was 50%. Now they can have a 70% capacity. But the government there have also raised the ceiling for airfares too. And they've even said, airlines might have to hit that kind of high ceiling fare to be able to operate at profit. And until airlines kind of reach a happy medium, domestic travel is not really going to happen, is it? You're not going to book a 2,000 ringgit flight unless you really have to be there. You know, you have to see your family or you have to travel for business. You're not going to go there for leisure.
No, and I think actually trying to get 2,000 ringgit for a flight to Borneo through your financial controller is going to be very difficult. Yeah, they can say, wait a week or two until this price comes down, because that's unsustainable. You know, that's way beyond the company's budget right now. So that takes us, we've looked at flag carriers, we've looked at LCCs. Mm. Should we look ahead a little bit and see where this may be going in future? It's uncertain, as we've said. You know, countries keep resetting when they're going to open the borders.
Yeah.
Everybody's very cautious about this, it seems.
Yeah.
These bubbles that we're talking about, particularly with Australia, well, that looks as though that's gone. Australia said it's certainly not going to open its borders until at least later in this year, quite possibly into 2021. The China factor has also happened this week, because we've no idea what's going to happen there. You wonder, with that happening, whether the Northeast Asian countries of Korea and Taiwan and Japan might also be a bit more cautious now.
Yeah.
So are we looking at an ASEAN bubble? Is that the only way to get flying going in this region? But if you do that, you've still got some countries which are really still fighting the first wave, particularly Indonesia.
Indonesia, the Philippines.
Singapore too.
Yeah, I mean, Singapore, they say the local transmission is much lower, but I mean, you've still got people with COVID there at the end of the day. And Indonesia yesterday finally overtook Singapore to have the most number of cases in COVID, despite relaxing their lockdown in Jakarta and in other areas. Who knows really whether that was the right move? I mean, it's a toss-up, isn't it, for a lot of these governments and these economies are between poverty.
Yeah.
And COVID.
And healthcare, it's the inflection point. It's absolutely true. And you can see that Indonesia feels it's hit that point, that it simply has to reopen.
Yep. You know, by doing so, they're inevitably going to delay their reopening and being able to open up the tourism. I mean, we've seen some airlines kind of talking about new routes, haven't we? So we've seen Cambodia talking about trying to open up routes with East Timor. That could be interesting. They even, I think, talked about opening some with Australia recently.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they were in discussions about that.
Of course, Vietnamese airlines, I think they're going to be leading the pack in opening up new international routes once those routes are available to them.
And then we have, obviously, the outside airlines, the international airlines that were really, really boosting connectivity here. You know, you look at the Middle Eastern carriers, Chinese, Japanese, Korean carriers, Turkish Airlines as well, which was really starting to make inroads into our region, but also China as well.
So it would be really interesting to see, as they come back, what kind of frequencies they're putting on
and prices.
Crucially.
And what demand? Because, you know, when you're looking at flights to the Middle East or to Turkey, you're looking at, what, eight, nine hours from Central Southeast Asia? That's a long time to be on a flight, you know, when you're only perhaps accustomed, your recent flight was 45 minutes between KL and Penang or intra-Indonesia or intra-Philippines, short routes. Are people going to be willing to take those longer haul flights?
Yeah, and then to potentially transit at these very busy hubs and continue on their journey, because that's obviously, you know, what a lot of people use Turkish Airlines for, transiting in Istanbul.
I would imagine that the transit situation will be very different to what it was before. I mean, if you travel through Dubai or Doha or Abu Dhabi, you have the freedom of these huge airports. It may be that you may be just contained in one room, that you literally have to be with the people that you flew with, people that are going to be on your next flight. But yeah, that's a logistical issue.
So what do we reckon? Is the situation any clearer now? I mean, let's hope so. That, you know, it's clearly really complicated, isn't it? Financially, it's complicated operationally, and it's going to be a long road to recovery for all of the airlines, both here in Southeast Asia and beyond.
I think what we've probably done is just actually just explain how complex it is. I don't think we've actually made it sound any easier, because it isn't. It's a very difficult situation. And while we have these travel bans and these quarantines and these border closures in place, the airlines really are only fighting for a small percent of a potential market that they would normally have. It's a very difficult situation for them. It's a very difficult situation for passengers, because we really don't know day from day, week from week, what's going to happen. But obviously, with air travel being such a vital part to the region's economy, and we'd love to hear your comments and your feedback on this episode, whether we made it clear or whether we didn't, whether we made it sound more complex than it actually is. So please send us a note by email to our usual address, hello@theseasiatravelshow.com, or via our Facebook page at the SEA Travel Show, or on Twitter, SEA Travel Show.
Also, look out for our daily travel and tourism insights and podcast news on our LinkedIn page, the Southeast Asia Travel Show. Reader numbers are growing pretty fast there, which is great. And of course, you can listen to all of our previous podcast episodes on our website, www.theseasiatravelshow.com, or on Spotify. Just search for the Southeast Asia Travel Show.
Yeah, and don't forget to sign up for our Friday mini briefing newsletter, which this week features Japan. And, Hannah, hot off the press, we're teaming up with Travel Daily Media, where you'll soon be able to listen to all of our podcasts and read exclusive Southeast Asian content that we're producing from them. So you can look out for our podcast. This latest podcast will be posted there at the weekend.
Exciting. Well, that's a wrap for this week's podcast. We're both off to work out where, when, and with which airline we can start flying again. And we both look forward to talking Southeast Asian travel and tourism again with you soon.
Yeah, bye-bye.